This is VOA News reporting by remote. I'm Michael Brown. Federal workers here in the U.S. are expected to be told today they will need to be vaccinated or submit a regular testing for the virus. President Joe Biden has only said he will speak about the coronavirus-related matters on Thursday. Workers in Washington and some other cities Wednesday began wearing masks again at work amid a spread of the Delta variant of the coronavirus that causes COVID-19. Signs began appearing Thursday in federal buildings, including the White House briefing room, requesting that even the vaccinated wear a mask. The governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, announced Wednesday that all state employees, a workforce totaling tens of thousands of people, must be vaccinated by Labor Day, September 6. New York becomes the second state after California to impose such a rule to its government workers. Big tech companies are making it mandatory for employees in the United States to get COVID-19 vaccinations before entering campuses, as the highly infectious Delta variant of the coronavirus drives a resurgence in cases. Alphabet Inc., Google, and Facebook Inc. said on Wednesday all U.S. employees must get vaccinated to step into offices. Google is also planning to expand its vaccination drive to other countries in the coming months. According to a Deadline report, streaming giant Netflix Inc. has also implemented a policy mandating vaccinations for the cast and crew of all of its productions. That's U.S. productions. As always, for more news, we invite you to join us at our website. That is voanews.com. Also on the VOA mobile app. By remote, this is VOA News. Japan on Wednesday reported more than 9,500 new coronavirus infections, an all-time high, raising fresh questions about whether the ongoing Tokyo Olympics are worsening the country's pandemic situation. Tokyo is already under a state of emergency that some local commentators have criticized as ineffective. Many of the rules are voluntary. For example, restaurants have been asked to close early and not sell alcohol. Not all have complied. Overall, Japan's pandemic approach has been relatively successful. It has reported only 15,000 coronavirus deaths, much fewer than other countries its size. And a major breakthrough for one of the world's last countries to embrace COVID-19 vaccine, Tanzania's president kicked off its vaccination campaign Wednesday by publicly receiving a dose and urging others to do the same. Samia Hassan, who received the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, expressed confidence in the safety of the vaccine, said the country of more than 58 million people will pursue more. The East African country's government under former President John Magufuli had long worried health officials by denying the pandemic. Magufuli, who insisted the coronavirus could be defeated with prayer, died in March. The presidency then went to Deputy Hassan, who has since changed Tanzania's course on COVID-19. The Afghan government in Kabul will be fighting for its life and could well fall to the Taliban after the U.S. completes its military withdrawal from the country in August, according to the U.S. government watchdog charged with monitoring events on the ground. Despite a serious and cautiously optimistic assessment by high-ranking U.S. military officials and Afghan leaders, a new report from the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan's Reconstruction described the situation as bleak and echoes concerns that Afghan security forces are not ready to mount any meaningful resistance. Ever since President Biden announced in April that American combat troops would leave Afghanistan, U.S. officials have been careful not to minimize the challenge facing the Afghan government. Afghan President Ashraf Ghani has also promised better results as well, saying that the Afghan military will be able to regain momentum by refocusing its efforts on defending urban areas. Help also has come from in the form of U.S. airstrikes in support of Afghan forces, despite the U.S. no longer having aircraft based in Afghanistan. For more news, please join us, voanews.com. I'm Michael Brown reporting by remote, VOA News. We'll be right back.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America and James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, July 29th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Tanzania's president becomes the first in her country to get COVID vaccination.
In a televised event held at the State House Wednesday, Tanzania's president Samia Hassan launched the country's vaccination campaign against COVID-19 by receiving her first shot of Johnson & Johnson vaccine.
Zimbabwe opens Victoria Falls, but only to vaccinated tourists. The United States briefs the media on the Prosper Africa Trade Initiative. Amnesty International says both Cameroon military and separatists have committed human rights abuses targeting civilians. But the separatists have reservations about the report.
I will say that Amnesty does a good job most of the time. But unfortunately, their reports are very slanted. They do not reflect exactly the truth on the ground.
And Kenya's Shona community is granted citizenship after decades of statelessness. Those stories and more coming up on Daybreak Africa. President Samia Suluhu Hassan got vaccinated Wednesday to kick off the country's first coronavirus vaccination campaign. President Suluhu Hassan has accepted a U.S. donation of over 1 million vaccine doses. Her predecessor, the late John Magufuli, claimed that vaccines were dangerous and that prayer has saved Tanzanians from the pandemic. Charles Kumbe reports from Dar es Salaam.
In a televised event held at the State House Wednesday, Tanzania's President Samia Hassan launched the country's vaccination campaign against COVID-19 by receiving her first shot of Johnson & Johnson vaccine. The Prime Minister, Chief Justice and other top officials also got their shots. The event marks a break with the late President John Magufuli, who dismissed vaccines and said God had protected Tanzania from the coronavirus. Speaking before receiving the vaccine, Hassan said, "It is safe and that those who are willing to get it have nothing to worry about." The president said she would not risk her life or put herself in danger while knowing that she has so many responsibilities awaiting her. She said she is also a mother, grandmother, and wife, and that as the president, she must show this to the masses who are behind her. Tanzania's health minister, Dorothy Gwajima, urged leaders to encourage people to get vaccinated. "I'm asking all our religious leaders, political leaders, and other leaders from each area in Tanzania to receive this vaccination. Encourage and educate others that this vaccine is a modern weapon to slow down COVID-19 and eradicates it completely as other diseases." Tanzanian citizens seem to have welcomed the campaign. Ibrahim Maximilian is a Dar es Salaam resident.
Ameonyesha jinsi gani ambavyo pengine tofauti na vile ambavyo hofu ipo.
He says the way the fear is presented, not only in Tanzania but also in the whole world, fear that these vaccines are not safe. Maximilian asked that if the president has dared on the front line to do that, he has shown that the vaccine is safe. James Tumaini, a Morogoro resident, speaking via messaging app, said that he believes that the vaccine is safe.
Lakini pia wapo wengi ambao wamepatiwa chanjo hii na bado hawajaripoti kupatwa na madhara yoyote.
Tumaini says there are many people who have received the vaccine and reported to have not faced any negative effects. On my side, I'm ready to get vaccinated, and I urge my fellow Tanzanians to also accept it since it has met the criteria of the World Health Organization. In a Twitter message Wednesday, the U.S. ambassador to Tanzania, Donald J. Wright, termed the president's act as a historic moment that hopeful marks the turning of a tide against the COVID-19 pandemic in Tanzania. According to the Ministry of Health, procedures and centers for the vaccination will be announced soon. But the ministry has already said priority groups will include healthcare workers, hotel workers, employees of foreign embassies, and international travelers, such as pilgrims, to Mecca. Charles Kombe for VOA News, Dar es Salaam, Tanzania.
Zimbabwe is opening its top tourism destination and one of the world's biggest waterfalls, Victoria Falls, to visitors who have been vaccinated against COVID-19. The falls have been closed to foreign tourists for over a year, but the government says more than 60% of people in the town have been vaccinated and so are at low risk. As Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare, Zimbabwe's suffering tourism industry has welcomed the opening.
Late Tuesday, after a cabinet meeting, Information Minister Monica Mchangwa told reporters that the government had resolved to lift a lid on Victoria Falls, the tallest waterfall in the world and the country's top tourism destination.
Cabinet acceded to a request by the tourism industry to open the Victoria Falls and Kazungula border post to tourists who are fully vaccinated. This is in view of the realization that over 60% of the population in Victoria Falls has been vaccinated. The lockdown measures, however, are being enforced throughout the country in order to contain a surge under this stage one.
Godfrey Korte, spokesman for the Zimbabwe Tourism Authority, says the pandemic had brought the tourism industry worldwide to its knees. He says it is time for Zimbabwe to begin the long climb back with the opening of Victoria Falls within the confines and guidelines of the COVID-19 pandemic.
From a regional perspective, the tourism traffic will start growing as well, and this will also send a very strong message to our source markets. And this is a definite way of showing also a benefit being derived from government's drive of vaccinating the entire city of Victoria Falls and subsequently Victoria Falls reaching herd immunity. So we are very excited to see this happening, and it can only show us that we are definitely moving in the right direction.
About 1.5 million Zimbabweans out of a population of 14 million have received their first vaccination shot, and nearly 695,000 have received their second inoculation. Clement Mukwasi is a spokesman for Shearwater, one of the tourism operators in Victoria Falls.
It is the industry's hope that towards the end of the pandemic, which we think we are in, there shall be some credit lines that are going to be extended to the industry for the industry to recover. We applaud the government for taking heed of our call to open the two borders of Zambia and Botswana, because Victoria Falls has reached its herd immunity. We are hoping that in addition to opening up the borders, they are also going to set up a policy on how people should flow across the three countries.
Mukwasi says those who are vaccinated should be allowed to move across the country without any problem, while those who are not vaccinated should produce results showing they have tested negative for the coronavirus, which causes COVID-19 disease. Zimbabwe currently has 101,711 confirmed coronavirus infections and 3,208 deaths, according to the Johns Hopkins University, which is tracking the global outbreak. The government says the vaccination program will intensify after the arrival of more doses from China in the coming days. The number of cases has been rising as the Delta variant becomes more widespread. Columbus Mavungam for VOA News, Harare.
The U.S. National Security Council's Senior Director for Africa, Dana Banks, briefed the media Wednesday on the Prosper Africa Initiative, which aims to increase trade and investment between the United States and Africa. Mohammed Yusuf spoke to economists about the potential and challenges to trade in this report from Nairobi.
The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has kicked off the Prosper Africa Build Together initiative by requesting $80 million from Congress to build trade and investment between the U.S. and Africa. Some experts say increased financial connections will strengthen ties between the U.S. and the continent. Speaking in an online news briefing Wednesday, the U.S. Senior Director for Africa at the International Security Council, Dana Banks, said the U.S. is ready to do business with the continent.
The campaign is a targeted effort to elevate and energize the United States' commitment to trade and investment with countries across the African continent under the Biden-Harris administration. And our goal is to substantially increase two-way trade and investment between the United States and Africa by connecting U.S. and African businesses and investors with tangible deal opportunities.
The Prosper Africa Initiative aims to increase trade and investment between the U.S. and the continent. It is not the first time the U.S. government has engaged Africa on trade issues. In 2000, President Bill Clinton signed the African Growth and Opportunity Act, the deal that provided African countries with unilateral duty-free exports for 6,500 products to the U.S. AGOA still exists and is extended until 2025. According to the Brookings Institute, South Africa got $917 million in 2019 by exporting automobile and agricultural products to the U.S. A separate study done by the University of South Africa in 2017 found that the U.S. imported 10% of its wine from South Africa, worth $59 million. The U.S. government is currently negotiating a bilateral free trade agreement with Kenya. Banks says America wants to participate in Africa's growth.
Africa's increasing integration into global markets, the demographic boom, and of course, the thriving culture of entrepreneurship presents a remarkable opportunity for us to strengthen those economic ties and promote new opportunities for both U.S. and African businesses to fuel economic growth and job creation and greater U.S. participation in Africa's future.
Gerishoni Kiara is an international economic affairs lecturer at the University of Nairobi. He says the initiative will help strengthen the relations between the U.S. and Africa.
The U.S. want to tap that both for economic reasons and the political and international relations reasons, because I think it is known all over the world that trade links also help to build political and diplomatic links all over the world. And this is key for both the U.S. and Africa as of now. And as I said, U.S. is also knowing more about African products, African culture, with many migrant workers from Africa working in the U.S.
However, some critics say the trade and investment plan could undermine the African Continental Free Trade Area, which was established in 2019. That agreement promotes the free movement of goods and people across the continent. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, July 29. Amnesty International says the Cameroon government and separatists have both committed human rights violations and abuses during the conflict in Cameroon's English-speaking regions. In a new report released Wednesday, based on eyewitness testimonies and analysis of satellite images, Amnesty accused both sides of targeting civilians. It says separatist attacks have particularly targeted Umbororo communities, a subgroup of Fulanis. Amnesty called on the international community to ensure adequate funding for humanitarian response to address the needs of civilians affected by the violence. Fabian Offner is Amnesty International's Central Africa researcher and one of the co-authors of the report.
We wanted to highlight the fact that many violences are occurring right now and since many years in the two Anglophone regions of Cameroon, the Northwest and the Southwest, but it's kind of under-documented because the access is quite complicated. Even the phone access is difficult, so we have very little information, also because the Cameroonian authorities control the information, so it's kind of difficult to have a neutral information between the Cameroonian authorities and the armed separatist groups. So we have been able to corroborate, thanks to public sources, also testimonies and satellite images, the fact that some villages, especially in the Northwest region, have just been devastated, you know, either by fightings between armed separatist groups and armed Fulani groups, or also by raids of the Cameroonian army.
So all the armed actors in the region have been implied in some human rights violation or abuses in the region.
So, Fabian, what do you hope for the international community to draw from this report?
Unfortunately, the international community has been silenced for too long. Everyone knows what happened to the Tungutan region of Cameroon. Everyone knows that there are many human rights violations. But so far, neither the UN nor the African Union has been able to document who has done what.
I spoke to a spokesperson for the separatists, and where you mentioned that the separatists have killed or have been killing the Mbororo ethnic group, he says that Amnesty got it wrong. The Mbororos were brought to the area by the Cameroon government to kill English-speaking Cameroonians. What's your response?
This is a very sensitive subject. The fact is, we wanted to focus on some specific human rights violations that occur in, especially in the Northwest region, implying especially armed separatist group and the Cameroonian army. But we have been able to document, and I'm not the only one who have documented this. Some Mbororo communities in the first years of the conflict have been targeted by armed separatist groups, and this has led to the creation of some armed Fulani group. And everyone knows, this is not a secret, that there are quite close relationships between some of these groups and the Cameroonian army.
Fabian Offner is Amnesty International's Central Africa researcher. He was speaking with us from Paris, France. A spokesperson for Cameroon separatists says while Amnesty International does a good job most of the time in its reporting, sometimes the reports are slanted and do not reflect the situation on the ground. In a report released Wednesday, Amnesty accused both the Cameroon army and separatists of targeting civilians. It says separatist attacks have particularly targeted Mbororo communities, a subgroup of Fulanis. But Chris Anu, Secretary of State for Communication of the Self-Declared Republic of Ambazonia, says there is nothing wrong with killing Mbororos because they were brought into the Anglophone region by the Cameroon army to kill Ambazonians.
I will say that Amnesty does a good job most of the time, but unfortunately their reports are very slanted. They do not reflect exactly the truth on the ground. For example, when Amnesty writes and say a woman was killed by separatist soldiers, Amnesty cannot as much as mention where that woman was killed and on what occasion. But I will also add that the idea that Amnesty will keep saying both sides, it is not both sides. Ambazonians are defending themselves. Ambazonians did not call for war. French Cameroon called for war. We have said it again and again that the moment French Cameroon lay down arms, withdraw their soldiers from Ambazonia, Ambazonia fighters will have nobody, nobody to fight.
So, Chris, what do you make of the report? It says that the separatists have been targeting or killing the Mbororos.
Again, James, that is what I am talking about, slanting. When Amnesty slants their reporting, Amnesty says separatists targeted Fulani Mbororos and killed them. But what Amnesty does not tell the people is that Mbororos in their hundreds descended on Ambazonia, brought in by the colonial officials in Indu, and they killed Ambazonians, burned down their homes, and destroyed their farmlands. Now, Amnesty does not mention this. I'd like to ask a question. What is wrong with Ambazonian killing an Mbororo who is an aggressor? You move into Ambazonia from another country, into our territory, and you attack our people and you kill them, burn their homes, and destroy their farmlands. If we are able to kill all of them, we will kill them all, and there will be no regret.
I asked the question because the struggle in Anglophone Cameroon began because of the claim of marginalization. But the Mbororos are also from the area. They are not strangers. So why are you targeting someone who is also from there?
No, James, that is not accurate. You just heard me say that the Mbororos came in from northern Nigeria, into Endu, and they started killing civilians with the complicity of the colonial divisional officer for Endu.
Chris, it's always a pleasure to speak with you, and thank you so much.
My pleasure, James. Thank you.
Chris Anu is the Secretary of State for Communication of the self-proclaimed Republic of Ambazonia. He was speaking with us from the U.S. city of Houston in Texas. In Kenya, more than 1,600 members of the Shona community who have lived in the country for decades as stateless persons were on Wednesday declared Kenyan citizens. About 900 members were issued national identity cards and other certificates of registration, ending a protracted struggle to be recognized as Kenyan citizens after more than 60 years of living in the country. Atiano Odhiambo reports from Nairobi.
The Shona people arrived in Kenya from Zambia and Zimbabwe as missionaries in early 1960s. After Kenya gained independence, they remained stateless because Kenya's post-independence constitution did not have a provision to confer citizenship to those of non-Kenyan descent. Oliver Muragerera, who came as a child with his parents and is one of the only four remaining Shona community predecessors, was among those who received national identity cards on Wednesday. He says their challenges began in 1978 after the death of founding father Mzee Jomo Kenyatta, when they felt they were no longer welcome. Muragerera says they soon began to lobby for recognition as Kenyan citizens.
So Mzee Jomo Kenyatta was very happy with our forefathers. He received them and gave them permission to preach all over Kenya. And from that time, we had a very nice life. Our problem started in 1978 when we heard that Mzee Jomo Kenyatta has passed away. We feel so sorry for our life because he was the one who was like a shelter to us by that time. So after that, our parents started to find the way whereby they can get IDs or to be identified.
21-year-old Nosizi Dube, who also received a national identity card, says it's like a day of freedom. She says she's lucky to witness the completion of the struggle to be recognized as Kenyans after being stateless for about 60 years and missing out on basic needs like education.
Today is a remarkable day for us. It's a day that we are free. We are free from all those challenges that we have faced. Stateless person, you're not recognized or entitled to any law, any jurisdiction of any country. So that means we don't even hold any legal documents like the national identity cards, the birth certificates, and even the national health insurance fund and others. When you reach class 7 in primary level, you have to register for the national final examination. And the first requirement is the birth certificate.
The road to citizenship began with a motion to Kiambu County Assembly, as majority of the Shona community reside in Kiambu County. It gained momentum in the National Assembly and finally the Senate before President Uhuru Kenyatta formally declared the Shona community the 45th tribe of Kenya. Samuel Kimani, a member of the Kiambu County Assembly who drafted a motion to give the Shona people citizenship, described some of the challenges the Shona people have faced.
I have grown up together with the Shona children. We went to school together, but actually all of them had to drop out when we were to do the national exam simply because they did not have birth certificates and therefore they could not proceed on because they could not register for the national exam. And therefore, when I was elected, I took it upon myself to fight for their rights and to make sure I also represent them well by having them have citizenship. So I did public participation. The people of Kiambu accepted that these people, we know them, we have intermarried, they speak our language, they were born here, they have all rights to be recognized as Kenyans.
Interior Cabinet Secretary Fred Matiang'i, who officiated the issuance of the national identity cards and registration certificates, said that Kenya, under the leadership of President Kenyatta, is keen on ending statelessness in the country by December 2021.
We've been working on these issues of ending statelessness in the country, and I'm very happy about the progress we have made. Our president, when he came to office in 2013, he determined that during his term, he will end statelessness in this country. And I can tell you, we are well on our way to completing that job.
There are about 3,500 members of the Shona community in Kenya, according to a recent count by the UN Refugee Agency. On Wednesday, 1,649 of them officially became Kenyan. Atieno Odhiambo, VOA Daybreak Africa in Nairobi, Kenya.
And that's it for this Thursday, July 29th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington.